What do we have between Edwards and modern apologetics, which we're going to go to now? Immanuel Kant. Let me summarize the course up to this point. The course up to this point has said, in the whole history of apologetics, up to this point, up to Kant, 1800, in the whole history of apologetics up to this point, everybody has been a classical apologist, including Tertullian. Everybody's held basically the same view. Now, what are the common elements in this view? There are some differences. They all believed in the use of reason. They all believed in general revelation and that it conveyed truth that all men knew. They all formed some sort of arguments for the existence of God or spiritual truths. They all believed that there was a historical apologetic and that in the historical apologetic, miracles were used to confirm prophets or the Son of God. Everybody, there was a different stress, to be sure. Some stressed one form of the argument, cosmological, some ontological, some teleological arguments. Some stressed more depravity and man's rejection. But they all believed that by your mind, through natural revelation, you could know enough truth about God to condemn you, and that a Christian could use reason and take the evidence that was available and present a convincing case for God exists, miracles confirm Christ to be the Son of God, which I call a two-step apologetic. Step one, God. Step two, Christ. The two-step classical apologetic with the use of reason. Nobody was a fideist. Nobody was a presuppositionalist. Now that in itself, when you're talking about 1800 years here, that in itself ought to say something about what's coming next. There's trouble in Rivers City. And the trouble is named K-A-N-T. How do you spell trouble? It's a four-letter word. What did Kant do? Of course, Kant is the one who said, you cannot know the real world. He built this great gulf here between the real world on this side and the world of appearance over on this side. And he said, you and I are locked over here. We have no way to get over there. Every time we get over there, we start talking in contradictions. Reason applies only on this side. You can apply faith over here. You can believe in this realm. And he did. He believed in God. Faith applies over here, but reason applies only over here on this side in the phenomenal world. What do we do, says Kant? Well, we believe, we posit. We talk about the preconditions of, which is called a transcendental argument. We transcendentally suppose that there's a God in order to fulfill the moral obligation that we feel. Therefore, he devised what's been called a moral argument. It wasn't really a moral argument, it was a moral postulate. We postulate a God to fulfill our moral obligations. There must be someone to be able to achieve this happiness that we seek. And with union, in union with the summum bonum, the greatest good in the next life. So Kant built a distinction between fact and value. He built a great gulf. And he said, value, the mystical, the real, whatever you want to call it, Wittgenstein called it the mystical. People have traditionally called it the real. Kant called it the noumenal world, and this is the phenomenal world. There's a distinction between the world of fact and the world of values. Science is over here on this side. Religion is over here on this side. You have this humongous gulf and gap that you cannot transcend. Now, as a result of Kant making this agnostic gulf, this non-cognitive, positing this non-cognitive realm and making a barrier between the cognitive and the affective, between what we can know and what we can believe. Modern presuppositionalism, fideism, pragmatism, existentialism, and you name it, all resulted. It wasn't a result of Hegel's upper story. Hegel's upper story is a result of Kant. Kant is really the villain and the crossroads, and everything flows from him. Now, I'm not going to take a lot of time with Kant. We go into that more in other places. I just want to note that the reason we now have presuppositionalists and fideists is because we're living in a post-Kantian world. If Kant is right, then two things follow. All of classical apologetics was wrong. Everything all those apologists did for 1800 years is wrong. I mean, that shows how important Kant is. Incidentally, most of the modern world accepts Kant. The Enlightenment accepts Kant. That's why you and I are in a very curious position in the modern world, because we're living in a post-Kantian world as though we were pre-Kantians. So what we have to do, really, is answer Kant in order to maintain classical apologetics. Now, let me tell you one of the most brilliant living Christian philosophers who has done that, in my opinion, in the most definitive way. I think probably one of the brightest, if not the brightest, Christian philosophers alive is Stuart Hackett. And Stuart Hackett, in his book, The Resurrection of Theism, which was originally published by Moody Press. That was the wrong press. It's now by Baker, which is better. It was reprinted and put out by Baker. That is a devastating critique on Immanuel Kant. It is the most incisive and brilliant critique. He lines them up, knocks them down. The Resurrection of Theism by Stuart Hackett. Stuart Hackett is a graduate of Western Baptist Theological Seminary way back when, and then he taught for 20 years at Wheaton College, and then the last 10 years of his life at Trinity Divinity School before he retired about a year ago. He's only written a few books, but they're all good. The one on Eastern religion is excellent. The one on apologetics, very good. And this one on the resurrection of theism is a classic. Another book, a classic book, if you can find it in a used bookstore, anytime you come across this book, buy it. If you don't want it, I'll take it. I have one of my own, but I'll take it. I know any number of people who will buy it. And that's Robert Flint, Agnosticism. Robert Flint was a Christian thinker at the turn of the century, and he wrote a whole series. The other ones are more easy to find, deism, theism, but his one on agnosticism is the best book on agnosticism from the last generation. I don't know if there's a better one yet on the market by a Christian. These two men, and if you want a third source, the father of modern neo-Thomistic thought, Garrigou Lagrange. It's in the back of the Philosophy of Religion book appendix, Garrigou-Lagrange, French Thomist. And he wrote a book on God, his existence, and nature. Has a whole section in there on Kant and answering the objections that Kant made. Those are the three best sources in print that refute Kant. In brief, here's what I would say to Kant. He is saying, I know you can't know. That you can refute Kant by showing that his statement that you cannot know the real world is itself a statement about the real world. He's saying, I know enough about the real world to tell you you cannot know anything about the real world. But see, agnosticism is self-defeating. It pulls the rug from under itself. It cuts its own throat because it is making statements about the real world to wit that statements can't be made about the real world. He's saying, you can't apply logic to the real world. But that statement is a logical statement about the real world. You say, well, how can it be that simple? How can you in 5 seconds refute 200 years of history? It's the way it is. It's the way it is. Hindsight is 20/20. We all get blinded by our own presuppositions. We all get caught up in our own day, in our own way, and don't see our own contradictions. I can see my wife's faults. She can see mine. It's very hard for me to see mine. Looking back at it, in the light of what's happened, we took the wrong road after Kant. And the modern world's got to go back, refute Kant, and say, look, reason does apply to reality, and you cannot deny reason of reality without using reason of reality. All right, what I want to do next is to take perhaps the most famous modern presuppositionalist, and we'll go into contemporary apologetics to do that. I want to take Cornelius Van Til. Now, why don't I start with someone before Van Til, like Duiverd? Because he's unintelligible. And because the value of him has been preserved in Van Til, and he is more intelligible, but virtually unintelligible. But we better take the one that's a little more intelligible. Van Til has influenced more evangelicals, including people at Dallas Seminary, than any other, I was going to say living, he died a few years ago, any other contemporary apologist. He has influenced more fundamental Bible-believing Christians than any other single 20th century evangelical apologist. That's why we take him. What did he believe? Well, he was a presuppositionalist. To put it in a nutshell, he believed that you must start with the presupposition that the triune God has revealed himself in Holy Scripture. That's where you start. You can't question that starting point. That's just the starting point you take by faith. That's why he's called a presuppositionalist. Any other starting point is to concede the absolute authority of God to a rationalist, an empiricist, to autonomous man. So you either start with the sovereign triune God who has revealed himself in Scripture, in your apologetics, on everything, and in everything. Or you start with autonomous man who has set himself up as the final authority. Which one are you going to choose? Obviously, for a Christian, no choice. We start with the sovereign God. Van Til once wrote a critique of my apologetics book, wasn't printed. It was very interesting because he summarized the book quite well. And then he got into what would be the response section, and it became virtually unintelligible. Now you can account for it in several ways. One, he was in maybe about 90 by that time, and you could say, well, maybe senility has set in. But if you look at it, it was typical Van Til. What he did, he was all through with expounding my book. He never then referred to it again. Never referred to a single point of it. And the first part of his critique was, in the beginning, God. Now that was the ultimate downer for me. I'm ignored from there on everything that I said, and he starts where he starts. The sovereign God revealed himself in Scripture. And then the rest of it was just his own exposition of what he thought the Scripture was saying. That's how his system worked. He didn't engage argument. If he engaged arguments, if he reasoned with me, he was accepting my ground. And no real red-blooded presuppositionist is going to accept common ground with autonomous man. He's going to start with the sovereign God. Okay, look at this. You get a feel for it. It's called the total picture, also called my credo elsewhere. My problem with traditional method. That's what we've been talking about, 1,800 years of it. This method compromises God himself by maintaining that his existence is only possible, albeit highly probable, rather than ontologically and rationally necessary. Two, it compromises the counsel of God by not understanding it as the only all-inclusive ultimate cause of whatever comes to pass. 3, it compromises the revelation of God by compromising its necessity. B, compromising its clarity. C, compromising its sufficiency. Compromising D, its authority. 4, compromises man's creation as the image of God by thinking of man's creation and knowledge as independent of the being and knowledge of God. On the traditional approach, man needs not think God's thoughts after him. 5, it compromises man's covenantal relationship with God by not understanding Adam's representative action as absolutely determinative of the future. 6, it compromises the sinfulness of man resulting from the sin of Adam by not understanding man's ethical depravity as extending to the whole of his life, even to his thoughts and attitudes. 7, it compromises the grace of God by not understanding it as a necessary prerequisite for renewal unto knowledge. Got to be regenerated first. On the traditional view, man can and must renew himself unto knowledge by the right use of reason. You can get a feel for where he's coming from. It's a totally different world. You'd wonder, is he a Christian apologist? Does he realize what's happened up to this point? It's a post-Kantian world, and he's beginning presuppositionally, starting from God and just pontificating down on man. Up until Immanuel Kant, there were no presuppositionalists. As a result of Immanuel Kant, apologetics, along with philosophy, took a turn toward fideism, existentialism, and presuppositionalism. Why? What did Immanuel Kant do that made it necessary for people after Kant to either, one, reject him outright, or two, become either a fideist, a pragmatist, or an existentialist?
He supposedly demonstrated that you can't know for sure spiritual or divine knowledge, and that you can only study what you can see.
Okay, one way to put it. Someone else. Why did Kant make it necessary to go toward a presuppositional apologetic if one accepted his conclusions? What were his basic conclusions? Conclusion number one, agnosticism. You cannot know the real world. Conclusion number two, when you start to think about the real world, you end up in contradictions. Conclusion number three, since reason is over on this side of the gulf, reason can't get to the other side of the gulf. All proofs for the existence of God are dependent on reason. Therefore, there's no way to prove the existence of God. Now, if those conclusions are valid, then obviously we can no longer be a traditional apologist, such as everybody from Justin Martyr on up through Paley were. Any question about Kant, his contribution, or the result? How did this get into evangelical circles? Well, interestingly enough, there is always a Lutheran and Calvinistic premise that fit very neatly with Kant. And since the Protestant Reformation came out of the same soil, German, the two joined together. And here's how they joined together. Protestants had always stressed the depravity of man and the need for revelation. So along come people like Luther and Calvin and stress that there is a kind of gulf there anyway, that the gulf that Kant talked about isn't simply a rational gulf, that we also have a spiritual gulf. And this seemed to fit very beautifully with what Kant had said, and take Luther's doctrine of total depravity, Calvin's doctrine of total depravity, that man in and of himself cannot attain salvation, that he's totally incapable of reaching salvation, and give that just a little twist, and you can see how Calvinists, after Kant, tended to become presuppositionalists, because they said, oh, well, that's fine. We don't mind what Kant did. He just told us what we already knew anyway. that natural revelation wasn't sufficient, that the image of God is so effaced, if not erased, in fallen man, that there's this inseparable gulf there. So now we just need to accept this revelation from God from the other side that breaks through to this side over here, and take our stand on the Bible, which is God's revelation to us. Problem number one. What's wrong with that? Why is it that what Kant said also applies to this? Why is it that using this way of responding to Kant, saying, well, we'll just say God broke through in a revelation on this side, and this will be our starting point, why do they are they subject to the same kinds of criticism that Kant gave toward all traditional arguments? That's right. You still have to reason, number one, about whether you should accept this revelation as God's revelation, because there's some other books over here, too, that claim to be revelation. So you still have to use your reason about that. Problem number two. What's another problem as to taking this starting point? Kant. You're going to have to reject Kant even to be a presuppositionalist, is what we're saying. Why? The Bible speaks in non-contradictory terms about the other side of the gulf. The Bible is speaking in rational, cognitive, propositional language about this God over here, so you're still going across the gulf that you can't go across. According to Kant, you can't get across that gulf. Solution to that, neo-orthodoxy. Along comes Karl Barth, and he said, see, to be really consistent with both Kant and the Protestant Reformation, you shouldn't accept propositional revelation at all. You should accept revelation, existential revelation. It can grab you, it can move you, you can have an encounter with it. So, Kierkegaard, Karl Barth, really dropped the bombshell. They are post-Kantian and immediately post-Kantian. We're talking about early 1800s. Kierkegaard lived 1812 to 1855, somewhere in there, in that period. And Kant died, I think, in 1812, somewhere around there. So we're talking about immediate post-Kantian, and Kierkegaard said, there is a gulf there. We have to leap over it by faith, accept this revelation that grabs us. The revelation that grabs us is personal encounter. It's an I-thou experience, now borrowing the language from Martin Buber, who is the Jewish existentialist. Martin Buber, Emil Brunner, said, anyway, this Protestant doctrine of an inspired Bible is a paper pope. We replace the personal pope with a paper pope. We want to reject this paper pope, propositional revelation, and accept just the what can come across and all that come across. Cross is that there is a God totally other that we can't really know by propositional revelation, but we can believe, we can have an encounter with. So neo-orthodoxy was the logical result of the same type of thing that the presuppositionalists were doing inconsistently. Now what's the only way to avoid both of those? Go back and reject Kant. Go back and show that Kant was wrong. Because if you don't show Kant was wrong, we're in as deep a trouble believing in propositional revelation as anyone else is in the post-Kantian world, because Kant destroyed the validity of that just as much as he destroyed the validity of theological proofs for the existence of God. Because they all go down the tube whenever you start to reason or think propositionally about anything on this side, the real world. Other alternative? Just say that the Bible is a propositional revelation. It's God's authorized parable. It's the way God wants us to think about him, but it's not the way he really is. And of course, some evangelicals have taken that route. Just say, I'll stick with propositional revelation, verbal inspiration, but I won't make any claim that the Bible is really telling me anything about God. It's kind of an evangelical agnosticism. A revelatory propositional agnosticism in which the Bible speaks only in equivocal, mythological, allegorical language, but not in descriptive, ontological language. The alternatives are very painful.
The only alternative open for an evangelical who wants to maintain that the Bible is a propositional revelation that tells us something about God is to reject Kant and go back and say the theistic arguments are valid, and we got to show why Kant was wrong. Now, how do we do that? Well, number one, we show that his agnosticism is self-defeating. He says, you know, you can't know. Number two, we show that his so-called antinomies were not antinomies. What was one of his antinomies? He said, every time you try and think about this side of the gulf, you end up in contradictions. Give me one of the contradictions and show me why it wasn't really a contradiction. And this is where Stuart Hackett comes in. I've praised Stuart Hackett many times this course before. I think he's one of the most brilliant living Christian philosophers. In his book, The Resurrection of Theism, Part 1, he goes through all of these step by step. He shows Kant's philosophy. He just dismantles it piece by piece, and he shows why his antinomies don't follow, and then he gives a strong theistic argument in the end. To me, he's the father of the whole classical, neoclassical renaissance in the evangelical world today. But give me an antinomy and answer it. What was one of Kant's antinomies? Paradox, he called them antinomies or paralogisms or contradictions. If you apply reason, okay, that was one of Zeno's paradoxes, and Kant had a form of it. But I'd rather not start with that one. That is one of the paradoxes. It probably won't be helpful to illustrate this point if we start with that one. Let's take one in the proof of the existence of God. Everything needs a cause, therefore there must be a first cause. But if everything needs a cause, then so does that, therefore there can't be a first cause. You see, he gave a thesis and antithesis. He started with a premise of reason. Reason says we got to get back to causes, so everything has to have a cause. Okay, if everything has to have a cause, then you have to have a first cause to get it going. That's reasonable. But if everything needs a cause, then so does the first one need a cause, and therefore it's not first. So you must posit a first cause, and you can't posit a first cause. What's the problem? The problem is you shouldn't think that way. Problem is that's what happens when you start thinking about reality in terms of rational premises. Therefore, don't do that. Well, that's Kant's argument. How do we respond to that? Everything that is caused has a cause, but not everything has a cause. There's a difference between saying everything needs a cause and everything that has a beginning needs a cause. And so what Kant does, in each one of his so-called antinomies, one, usually the thesis or the antithesis, is wrong. We don't say everything needs a cause. We only say every finite thing needs a cause. Therefore, if you get back to an infinite, it doesn't need a cause. We don't say everything needs a cause. We say only everything that began needs a cause. So if you get back to something that didn't begin, it doesn't need a cause. Now here's another antinomy. This is a, you'd call this the antinomy of time. The universe must be eternal, and the universe must be temporal. Why must it be eternal? Because you can go back moment after moment after moment forever. Why must it be temporal? Because there had to be a first moment. Well, what's wrong? Which one of those two is wrong in his antinomy? The first one. We showed that before in the horizontal cosmological argument. You don't have to go back forever. In fact, to go back forever is to assume that time is eternal, that you can add up moments of time forever, and you can't add up moments of time forever. Now, you can go down every one of Kant's antinomies and do the same thing. Here's another one. God, if the world had a beginning, then God must have created it in time. But if God created it in time, then God was before time. But if God was before time, then there was time before time. but you can't have time before time. That's a contradiction. So how do you answer that? You were going to give an answer to that before. What did you say? That's right. That's the answer. The answer is that he's falsely assuming that there was time before time. There was no time before God created time. There was just eternity. When God created, that's the beginning of time. So God did not create in time. He created time. It's not a question of the creation in time. It's a question of the creation of time. And if God created time, then there was no time before time. All there was God. The eternal. Now you can do that with every one of Kant's antinomies. Every one of his antinomies has a wrong thesis or an antithesis. And if that's the case, then we have sufficiently answered Kant. We've shown that the gulf is self-defeating, that agnosticism does not necessarily follow, because we can think reasonably about God without falling into contradictions. And if we can think reasonably about God without falling into contradiction, then classical apologetics still stands, and we don't need to reject classical apologetics and jump into fideism or presuppositionalism. Any thoughts or questions before we move on? You have a puzzling look. If God created time, if this is the timeline right here, this is the beginning of time, right at that point, in the beginning, that's Genesis 1:1, and this line is time, then to ask any question, to use before, the question before, in a temporal sense, to say, well, what was God doing before, is a category mistake, because before is a temporal term that you're using when there was no time. So what was God doing before time is a category mistake. Who was God before time is not. It was the eternal one. So you can ask, who was or is? He always was and is the I am. Once you say, here's the other view, here's the timeline that goes on forever, and at this point in time, God decided to create. So you've got kind of an eternity of time spread out there. And then one day, properly used day, one moment God said, now I'll create. What's the problem with that view? That here's time spread out there before God. He's had all these moments forever, and a lot of moments went by. And then one moment God said, I'll create at this moment. And so he created in time rather than the creation of time. What's wrong with view number two? You gotta be careful with that. He does not exist in time. But time does exist for him.
Does that put God below time?
Which one? This one?
Yeah.
Does this put God below time? No, but it does put God within time. It makes God subject to time. In fact, it's a form of dualism. It puts time out there, outside of God. There is something outside of God to which he is subject, time. In other words, time was always there outside, almost like space. You know, here's infinite space, and God has not put anything in it. There is infinite time, and God hasn't acted in it yet, and at one moment, at one point, then he acts in it. So you got a kind of Platonic dualism. That's exactly what Plato had. It's a form of Platonism. It's always been tempting to Christians, and then all you have to do is take this thing out here and make it into one pole and make God into another pole, and what do you have? Process theology. God's got a temporal pole and an atemporal pole. You put the two together, and really, process theology is just ancient Platonism brought up to date. Or as Whitehead put it, the history of Western philosophy is a series of footnotes on Plato. This is the last footnote on Plato, where you take this something that was outside of God, make it part of God. Instead of an eternal dualism there, you put the dualism in God and you give God two poles. There you have Whitehead, Hartshorne, Cobb, Ogden, and the modern process theologians. Category mistake, because before is a temporal term, and you're asking, you're really asking, what time was it before time began? See, on this model, model number one up here, where God creates time, time doesn't begin until you have a changing world. What is time? Computation according to a before and after. You cannot compute unless something is changing. Whatever doesn't change doesn't have a before. That's why you can't say when God was young or when Gabriel was 12. Since God doesn't change, there's no way to compute a before and after. He's always the same. I am. Only beings that change can be in time. God can't change, therefore God can't be in time. Once you put God in time, then you have automatically made God a changing being. That's what process theology does. That's what people want to do, even in the incarnation. They want to make the divine nature part of time. The divine nature of Christ never was and never can be part of time. Only the human nature of Christ can be part of time. Why? Because the divine nature can't change, and whatever is in time must change. Therefore, the divine nature cannot be in time. Only the human nature of Christ is in time. The divine nature is in eternity. The divine nature is eternal. The human nature is temporal, and he has two natures co-joined in one person, not overlapping, not separated, tangentially meeting, the circle on the corner of the triangle again. If you don't do that, then Kant is right. Even our doctrine of the Trinity, the Incarnation, is a contradiction. And it is absurd. It shouldn't be believed. Any questions about creation in time or of time? How do we explain eternity? The word before can be used in two senses. It can be used in an ontological or a chronological. And we say it is appropriate to ask before ontologically. In other words, there was, God had some sort of priority to time. He had an ontological priority. He always was the eternal one. So what was God being before time? That's a good question. He was being the eternal one. What was God doing? That's not a good question, because that supposes a sequence. That's a category mistake. So before in an ontological sense, yes. Before in a chronological sense, no. Because there were no moments before moments began. The creation of the world was the first moment. Then the next moment, after there was a change, then you can look back and say, oh, that was before. Now, what can you do before that first moment? Well, there weren't any temporal befores before the first temporal before. So it's meaningless to ask who made God. It's meaningless to ask who caused Lucifer to sin. It's meaningless to ask what moment was there before moments began. There weren't any moments before moments began. The first moment was the first moment.
Therefore, God had to be and not do until time.
The first thing God did externally was create the world. That's the first thing he did. And he did it from eternity. God created from eternity, but he created time. Pardon? Everything God did, he did from eternity. For example, the second coming of Christ to earth is an act of God from eternity. Remember Aquinas' illustration, the doctor gives a pill a day for the next 7 days. When you take those pills, you are fulfilling the single decree that the doctor made prior to all of those events, one after another. So they happen later in time, but they were sovereignly decreed from eternity. So everything that ever happens, every thought we're thinking today, was decreed from all eternity. And the thought you're going to think an hour from now was decreed from all eternity, but it hasn't yet happened, but it was still decreed. So the effect of God's decrees are in time, but God's decrees are beyond time.
I guess I have a hard time understanding what you're saying, because you say decreed from eternity, but yet when we ask about eternity, you say there's nothing.
No, I didn't say there was nothing.
I mean that's what I...
That's what you get in your mind. Not the first time this happened, so don't feel badly.
I understand that God created angels individually by himself and also by the eternal generation, and all those things imply that there must have been something, somehow. God must not have been just playing around when he created
us. Well, of course God wasn't playing around, because playing around assumes what? There was time to play around. There was no time to play before there was time. All those questions are category mistakes. It's assuming that, and that's exactly the problem that Kant had. He said, space and time cannot be applied to the numeral world. Space and time cannot be applied to the numeral world. Well, of course, if numeral world means God, and God is eternal, then there's a sense in which that's correct, isn't there? You cannot talk about God in spatial terms and really be describing God. You cannot talk about God in temporal terms and really be describing God. Now, if you assume that God is spatial or temporal, then you have serious problems from a biblical standpoint, because the Bible says he created the space-time world, and that reduces him to the space-time world. Either he had to create himself, or he needed a creator, because he's just space and time. So the problem is, that's a category mistake to assume the spatial-temporal things apply to a God who is immense, non-spatial, and eternal, non-temporal. And the reason you come up with nothing in your mind is very important, because you are trying to get a spatial-temporal concept of a non-spatial, non-temporal entity. You are trying to think univocally about God rather than analogically. And you can't think univocally about an infinite, eternal, simple being. You can only think analogically. I didn't say God didn't do anything before time. If you take by that to mean that there was some time to do it, and he decided not to do it,